It's Wednesday, June 20th, 2007, and you're listening to episode 57 of Fear the Boot, a show about tabletop role-playing games and a little bit more. Running time for this episode is 52 minutes. Welcome to Fear the Boot. My name is Dan, and on the mics with me today is Chad.
Howdy.
John.
Hey.
And Adam.
Hi.
One day you're going to go out of order. You're going to be like, here's John, then Chad, then Adam. It's just going to be like...
Oh, he's done that before. He's done it before.
Has he?
Yeah.
You know what we have to do? We have to organize one time.
Well, see, nobody can tell the difference at home because they don't see the order you're sitting in. So for all they know, I did just go like 2-1-3 around the table. Yeah.
Well, you know, we need to organize one time, like you say, and on the on mics, we have Chad, and then Adam says hi, and then, you know,
No.
That'd be crazy.
We already get complaints that they can't tell me and you and me and John apart. Apparently, I have this omnifaceted voice that sounds...
Well, clearly, we're all just Dan, because, yes. You know, Dan has this whole mixer, and he just mixes different voices and such.
You're very talented.
I am. I disagree with myself a lot, too.
Mm-hmm.
That's kind of creepy.
The games I run are completely outlined, yet I disregard the outline.
Except for the part about capital ship broadside combat.
That's completely figured out. That's double outlined. All right, so we have this here little Olympic competition going on at Fear the Boot called the Power 16. Ooh. In which 16 mighty artifacts of Fear the Boot are all going in head-to-head, single elimination, March Madness-style competitions. And because of the way these shows are recorded, we're doing 1 week on, 1 week off. And the release of this episode marks the beginning of the next round of the Power 16. So if you want to enter this and you want to get your votes known, you need to go to our website, feartheboot.com, and look along the top for a link to the Power 16. I think you can also get to it at feartheboot.com/power16. And as an FYI, just so people have some faith in the process, yes, I am aware that it allows you to vote multiple times because I was too lazy to put in any kind of data validation on there.
Nice.
But my day job is programming, so I want you guys to know that I am recording some stuff like IP address. And when I tabulate the results, I do count uniquely by IP address. So somebody voting 100 times from the same computer is not going to get 100 votes.
But I voted 2,000 times for hard gay.
Well, it didn't
I made a tour of my local libraries from individual IPs.
I heard the first part of that sentence, and I am already crying on the inside.
Well, I was going to say it didn't help you because I would have sorted out IPs. Now, John's method would have worked. So there are ways around this, and I know that.
$300 in gas money later, John wins.
This is not exactly anyone's bank account, so I don't have massive security wrapped around it, but there is enough there to keep the honest people honest. So let's get down to it. The first matchup was the Well Giant versus the Menstruo Zombie.
Yeah.
Second matchup was the Aarakocra versus the Demon Gnome with the Magic Staff.
You're saying it wrong again.
I'm sorry, the Demon Gnome with the Magic Staff.
There you go.
That's funny every time.
It is.
Third matchup was Hardgay versus the Sexual Care Bears. Fourth matchup was Batman versus Mr. Body Massage Machine.
The matchup we're all waiting for.
And I am pleased to announce that we had over 200 unique IP addresses vote on this. So we'll just say 200-ish voters. I'm going to let you guys try and guess how this turned out.
All right, go for the first one.
Batman.
Well Giant versus the Menstruo Zombie. Who do you think won?
I'm going to go say the Menstruo Zombie.
I'm going to say the Menstruo Zombie, too.
Chad?
I can read your screen there, so
well, then you don't get to guess, jerk.
Yeah. Nobody likes you. At 114-93, the Well Giant took that round.
Useless.
What?
The second matchup,
because he's deep.
Aarakocra versus the Demon Gnome.
Aarakocra.
Demon Gnome.
Adam would be correct. At 120-89, the Demon Gnome won.
Oh, yeah.
Hardgay versus the Sexual Care Bears. This was actually the closest matchup that we had. The smallest margin, Sexual Care Bears and Hardgay.
I've thought long and hard who I'm going to pick for this, and I'm going to have to go with Hardgay.
John?
I'm going with the Care Bears.
Now, do you go with Hardgay because you think that he legitimately won, or do you go with Hardgay because you have supreme loyalty to the buffet of manliness.
I think we've mentioned the buffet of manliness more recently than we have the Care Bears.
He also said he thought long and hard about this.
I didn't think long and hard.
All right. Well, 110 to 101, a 9-vote difference. So if you think your vote doesn't matter in this democratic process, you are wrong. 9 people made this decision, and Hardgay will go on to the second round.
I voted Hardgay for president.
Our final matchup, and this one surprised me only because the voting disparity was so great. This was a landslide. Batman versus Mr. Body Massage Machine.
John, where are you going?
Batman.
I'm going to go Mr. Body Massage Machine because we've mentioned this more recently.
You guys willing to put a little bit of money down on that last one?
No. Shut up. What is it?
Are you sure? You guys have a little bit of a gambling problem, I know.
No, I only gamble when I can win or when it's going to end in embarrassment that's worth the $50. Read Metal Slime Tattoo.
I like my Metal Slime Tattoo.
143-66.
Wow.
Batman takes it in a landslide.
Wow.
That's right. Batman.
I am surprised. I really thought. So this round, it sounds like overall, went to the Shadowrun League, given the fact that the Rifts League just lost its commissioner.
Yeah.
Ouch.
He's going to be commissioning from the sidelines.
Mr. Body Massage Machine is gone. Now, if you want to vote on the Power 16, so you have between now and Monday, June 25th, to get out there and get your votes in for the second round. Adam, do you want to tell us who is up in the second round?
No, I forgot. Do I need to go get my man purse?
You do need to go get your man purse. Your
purse.
As Adam is getting out the list of the next round, I want you guys to know if you go to our forum, probably in the announcement area, I will go ahead and put up a picture that shows where the voting started and where it is as of this episode. So you'll see the results from round one, and Adam now is going to give, well, I guess this is the second half of round one, because this is still, this is just the other half of the teams in the Shadowrun League and the Rifts League going head to head. Adam, what are the matchups for this week?
We have some rough matches in the Shadowrun League this week. Don Shadowrun, commissioner of the Shadowrun League.
And inventor of the game Shadowrun.
And inventor of the game Shadowrun.
Soul inventor.
Versus Phil, the ultimate in hard-ass gaming.
Let's all go
fly in my train.
And if you go to the forums, you can go to the shameless plug section and see Phil's personal campaign to get people to vote for him.
Phil's out there trying to drum up votes, and there's some great Photoshop pictures in there that are definitely worth the clicks.
And you know what? I don't see any Don Shadowrun boosters.
That's very true.
I know. I'm shocked. Don Shadowrun has a vast staff of wicked magicians, and not one of them has come forth. So who else do we have in the Shadowrun League?
The Shadowrun League, another match to watch. Kane versus Baron Von Badass.
Oh, my.
It's going to be a rough match
to watch. Can I give my opinion on this one?
I can already tell you, I think I know who's going to win that one, but I'm not going to say it because I don't want to influence the vote.
Yeah.
Mm-hmm. Personally, in my mind, that's a tough choice, but I don't think it may be as tough for the folks at home. All right, what do we have over in the Rifts League?
The Rifts League, we have Vin Diesel versus The Kaz. Bill Cosby himself.
Bill Cosby versus Vin Diesel, okay?
You know, some people might not know, why is Vin Diesel on this list?
Because a little known fact, at least among the general public, fairly well known in the gaming community, is that Vin Diesel is actually an avid role player. He is a huge D&D fan. In fact, he has said that characters he's played in movies have been based on his D&D characters.
Yeah, like Riddick.
Yeah.
Is based on one of his D&D characters.
He's a dark elf or something like that.
He has a Riddick tattoo that he got before the movie, you know, that's of his D&D character and such on him.
So he's a really big avid role player, which is why we have him in there. And Bill Cosby, of course, just because, you know, he's Bill Cosby.
I watched House of Cos again the other day. It's still hilarious.
I just saw his comedy, Bill Cosby himself, which the first time I saw, and it was released, I think, in 83. And I saw it when it was fairly new on VHS tape at my grandparents' house. So,
who's the one where he's got the dentist routine?
Yes.
Oh, my God, that's great.
It is great. All right, so, Adam, who's the last matchup in the Rifts League?
Christopher Walken versus the Hardvark.
Ooh. Two highly intimidating and sexually charged individuals.
Indeed.
And, of course, by that, I mean that the Hardvark's intimidating. Christopher Walken is
sexually charged.
So, these are the matchups to watch, and actually don't watch them. Get out there and vote on them. Let your voice be heard on the Power 16.
I will be voting.
And we are going to announce the final round of voting when we are down to our last two. We'll actually run for 2 weeks. And we will announce the winner in the episode that we record at Gen Con.
Ooh.
So if you want to know early who won, you got to come meet us at the podcaster meet and greet, which is going to be 7 o'clock on Saturday. Also, it looks like, I don't know for sure, but I believe I'm actually going to be sitting in on two panels there. And if it works out the way I think it is, well, I'll find out for sure and I'll let you guys know. But I believe I'll be...
Can we heckle you from the audience?
You can.
Yeah, and if you want to hang out with Adam or I, we'll be getting drunk while Dan's talking.
Mm-hmm. Actually, that's probably where I'll be.
Come meet us at Gen Con and we will announce the winner then. We're actually already working on our next Power 16, which might include things like Robo Reagan.
Mm. We can't do it immediately, though.
That starts to cheapen. It will be a long time off. These have to be...
Reagan has to be transplanted into his cybernetic body.
These things take time.
They do.
Now, speaking of things from the Reagan era being transplanted into robotic bodies, John, you just picked up the Saga edition of Star Wars.
I did.
Or, as we like to call it, D&D 4th edition.
All right, well, let's introduce this first for people that aren't up on this kind of stuff. For those people still stuck back in the days of FAST and TSR, what is the Star Wars Saga Edition?
All right. Well, as you probably all know, there's a current edition of the Star Wars RPG inevitably floating around out there. It's probably the surest cash cow in the RPG industry aside from Dungeons & Dragons. Saga Edition is their effort to universalize the RPG system to cover all 1 through 6 of the Star Wars episode movies, rather than being as slanted to the prequels as the recent games have been. Also, as Chad, you mentioned, some people think it's the precursor to 4th edition, since it's very much like D&D 3.5, but not quite.
Now, the rumors about 4th edition that tie into Star Wars Saga, could you give us a few of those things that you think point towards a 4th edition?
Sure. The biggest one I saw was the revamping of skills and proficiencies into skill trees, a la Dark Age of Camelot in World of Warcraft. I think a lot of people have said that's like been coming for a long time. Talent trees.
Yeah.
Which they kind of have now, because like if you want some of the various feats, you have to take precursor feats.
Exactly.
But you're saying that now they have formalized this into a tree.
Yes.
Does it actually have a tree graphic?
It does not have a graphic. It is a very loose tree.
Well, you know what?
Well, like, flowchart, man.
It's not flowchart style. There's only one or perhaps two requisites. The high-end skills have a requisite skill, which itself has a requisite skill.
You know what? Just give it a little time. Somebody will come up with some Java application. And just like in World of Warcraft, where you can line out your talent trees online, they'll probably have that for D&D characters, to where you can optimize it and see it all in nice little graphic, little icons and everything.
Now, this part of it, to me, I just kind of, I don't know.
It's kind of cosmetic. It's a mechanics change. Character advancement has become much more dramatic as well. You get, I think, twice as many stat points at the stat up levels, and it's significantly more, it's more feat-based than class-based. They've cut classes down to 5. Now, I seriously doubt they're going to do that for D&D. There's no way you could cut it down that low.
Well, you can just combine Bard and Barbarian. I mean, they're pretty close.
Well, yeah, they're right next to each other. They start with
they
B.
They start with B.
Yeah.
They
start
B-A.
B-A-R. B-A-R. So
one of them is a BA and the other is not.
Did they do away with the skill system, or is the skill system still in there?
It's still there, but it's kind of different now. You can't spread ranks out like you could in 3.5. Not that anyone did. You just pick a new one and you get it, and then you've got it. They're a lot more centralized too. Like, for example, the one that everyone's been bringing up on the forum thread is use the force is now a skill. I mean, how wide is that?
No, it's not actually a skill where you use the force. It's how well you deliver that line. It's just like, use the force. And everyone's like, ooh, wow, he's got a high skill in that.
He's
it's
the
like
metagaming skill.
At rank 1, you sound like Gilbert Gottfried. And at rank 20, you sound like Sir Alec Guinness. Or perhaps James Earl Jones. They will eventually come out with an epic set for the level 21 to 40 campaigns where you can get high enough to sound like me.
But, 40? Oh, my God. That's terrifying.
Now, here's that part kind of, it doesn't bug me. You know, they're changing the game mechanic a little bit, but that's fine.
Yeah, I'm not up in arms. I mean, these changes are significant, yes, but Is this fundamentally going to be any different than running your basic D20 game? I don't think so.
Now, here's what worries
Except
me.
The minis.
And I think that's the part. Here's the part that worries me and I think points to a great evil that is about to be unleashed in 4th edition. John, talk about the whole minis thing.
Okay, so I'm flipping through the book, you know, real quick, just trying to get a general feel, and I notice something. Distance is not measured in feet in the rules sections about combat or anything. It's measured in squares. And I realize, oh my god, they've configured this whole game for the minis. And sure enough, I flip to the very beginning, which naturally, you know, you read last. And, yeah, the preamble to the whole document talks about how well the Star Wars minis line has been doing for the last few years. And how now there's this great game you can use your minis in.
So what we're basically saying is that if this is the precursor to 4th edition, the new D&D is not just going to be a role-playing game. Well, it is not meant to be just a role-playing game, but it is also going to be a tabletop miniatures game and WotC is going
West
to...
West End?
WotC is actually going to...
Standard Oil.
WotC is actually going to sell you all the miniatures.
Right.
So not only are you going to have to buy all the books and adventures and all the other stuff they want you to buy, they're also you're also going to have to... Not have to, but...
I don't like that pen and paper is no longer...
Pen and paper.
Yeah. Pen and paper and miniatures and map.
Pen, PDF sheet, mini map.
Historically, when you play an RPG, all you really needed was... A book or two or three or four, whatever, some number of books.
You usually could cheat it down to one or two, no matter how many they said you needed.
Exactly. Blank paper, pencils, dice, you're ready to go. This is all it took. That you made some investment, and if you wanted to really get deep into it because you're a fan, you could spend a ton of money on all the stacks and stacks and stacks of additional books.
Ew.
But all it took to play the game was really some relatively small number of things. But it sounds like the direction they are taking... They kind of took with 3rd edition.
That was the start.
They're taking more so with Star Wars Saga Edition. And rumor has it, and this is purely rumor, they are going to dive headfirst into in 4th edition, is that this is no longer just a game. This is a product line.
Yeah.
See, the thing is, I
don't see, like, the rules that they have now. I mean, it's just screaming for miniatures that you have to buy miniatures.
It really is.
Because
well, I mean, that's a continued revenue source, too.
Yeah, exactly.
You buy the book, you don't need the book again.
Yeah, no, you can translate six spaces to 30 feet, which is exactly what they're doing.
Okay, let's say I don't want to use miniatures and we just want to do a traditional pen and paper and we talk it out. Well, now the rules say, well, you have to, if you want to follow the rules, which if you're buying the book, I'm assuming you want to follow the rules.
Right.
That you have to do.
How many books have you bought?
I'm not a rules guy. That's
right.
Different, though.
I follow what he's saying.
I mean, you have to do attacks of opportunity and flat-footed and this and that. And then it's just like, how do you talk that out? You have to have references.
Can't.
So the game is written for you to buy this additional stuff. I think that you can make a counter-argument and say, well, what about your beloved Battletech? There's a game that you have to buy it. You know, you have to buy the miniatures to do that. But you know what? Going into Battletech, I know this. It seems to me that WotC is kind
of
sliding this. And there's
the map combat that's specifically miniatures based, and then there's the non.
Well, but then, right, but then also even with the map combat, you could buy a box set that had everything you need into it.
Exactly.
And I realize we've gone through inflation, but the cost of that box set is less than a single D&D book is. So, and like Adam said, if you pick up the RPG, you didn't need any of that. And Chad, what you said is exactly right. I mean, I realize the counter argument here could be, well, you don't have to use those rules. You know, if you don't want to play with minis, don't play with minis. Just talk it out and imagine your head like you always have. And with 3rd edition, which is not full force into this mini thing, it's just kind of one foot in there. We tried doing that and had tons of problems because so much of the game is centered around exactly how far you are from your enemy. Are they passing between you and another guy? And you can talk that out to some degree, but there comes a point where if you've got a party of four or five guys and they're facing down 10 or 12 zombies, then you can't keep track of that.
No, that point is when you get Chain Guy in your PC group with his 10-foot reach, who insists that he ought to be getting at least one more extra attack at the beginning of the round.
And you know, this stuff matters because we had several D&D games where we tried talking this out, and we as the players were getting cheated out of a variety of powers because it's like I've said in previous podcasts. squares 5 feet. Every single time we wanted to do anything, the enemy was 5'1" away.
Yeah.
Every time they wanted to do something, they were 4'11" away. And the game is so centered around it that you can't get away from it unless you mark up the book so bad and throw out so many rules that, quite frankly, you might as well just be playing second edition anyway.
And that's a universal rule of gaming. But
Let me ask you guys this. Let's just cut through it right now. If Wizards of the Coast is going into this direction of making you buy miniatures so that they can increase their revenue stream by making the game, whether it needs it or not, to have those miniatures in them, do you think that that is a good thing, a bad thing, or that's just a thing? That's how D&D is. If you don't like it, don't buy it.
I think they'll make money off of it.
I think it's a good thing.
Why?
They're going to have to do something to evolve what they've got. And they might as well be doing something as opposed to nothing.
That's true, too.
I'm hoping that it fails and they learn from it. No, yeah. Seriously. Yeah. I hope it fails and they're like, oh, well, we need to take this in a new direction because this isn't what people want. I probably won't, though. Given the amount of gamers who are into that type of gaming.
Yeah.
That eliminates...
Frankly, I think it's fun. I like minis. I don't want to use them every game.
Yeah, exactly.
But,
I mean,
major combat encounters, they're...
Fourth edition comes out, I'll buy it.
I agree. I'm not anti-mini. I play games with minis. It's just, it bothers me the extreme they're going to here. Now, having...
My problem with it is that it just seems very underhanded.
Well, I don't think it's underhanded. It's an evolution.
And I don't think that it's amoral. I don't think that it's unethical. My thing, if you don't like it, don't buy it.
Vote with your dollars.
Yeah, vote with your dollars, and that's all cool. And they want to take their game in that direction, that's fine. I don't know. It just seems to me, whether it is or not, just seems a little shiesty.
Well, they've been lubing you up for a few editions now, so
yeah.
I mean, you didn't buy 3.5 and
right.
Chad, you're asking whether this was a good thing or a bad thing.
I think it's a snazzy business move.
From their standpoint, I'm sure this is a good thing because it's D&D. People are going to buy it. Are going to play it. If this was just random game X, whatever that may be, this probably would not sell real well.
Yes.
But given the fact that it's D&D, the name power alone, people are going to go out and buy
it. That is a negative, too, for everyone else who don't like the mini direction. D&D is going to sell. There's your market data. Now, did D&D sell or did the miniatures sell?
Right.
Yeah. Yeah.
I personally, unless I see something that just really impresses the heck out of me, I don't see myself picking it up. I have seen and been introduced to so many other solid products that fit the more traditional mold of an RPG where you get your book, your pencils, your paper, and your imagination that I would rather stick with than a product line that I don't see myself moving into this. And, you know, and that's not just me saying, well, I'm going to stick with my dusty old fashioned TSR games. I could walk out there today and get any number of great games that are brand new that aren't going to require a Warhammer 40,000 type investment to get started.
Well, let me ask you guys a question because I was never big into second edition.
Nor was I.
I am.
All right. But these two,
you use the past tense, you fool.
All right. Well, is what you're hearing now about 4th edition the same thing that people said about 2nd edition to 3rd edition?
I don't know, and the reason is because it was right around the time 3rd edition was being released that I stopped following RPGs, and so I really found out 3rd edition had hit after it had hit. I'm now, of course, keeping up with these things again through the podcasting community and whatever, but the simple answer is I don't know.
No, I always thought...
My answer is no. There were apprehensions as the edition changed, as there always would be, but...
Well, I mean...
I think third edition's a better system. I mean, everybody knows I'm not a crunchy rules number guy, but honestly, Bin Bars, Lift Gates, Thaco's, the whole second edition was ridiculous.
Really? I know a lot of people would vehemently argue with you.
Yes, they do.
I will have to say, I like second edition and third edition both. I think in terms of feel, they convey different things, and... I understand where Chad's coming from. There was a lot of rough edges on the rules of second edition.
Yeah.
There was no
class balance either.
Well,
the grievous injury.
Yeah. And
Rogue, you just level twice as fast.
Some of those rough edges, they smoothed out. And in other places, I think the things they changed didn't need fixing.
Yeah. And
that's true.
And on the second edition people, and I think I'm going to anger a lot of people with this following statement. So we'll apologize in two or three episodes on this. But I think that there are two kinds of second edition fans. I think that there are the people who truly like the mechanics, and they say, you know, Thakos work for this reason, and you know, Ben Barzal's case were
Thakos are completely needless.
Yeah, and you know, all of this stuff that they line out, this is why I like it. And third edition, this stuff I don't like, and the flat-footedness, and the this, and the attacks on it, it's just ridiculous. I have no use for it.
You know, Lit is never flat-footed.
I think that the second camp of people who are big fans of second edition are nostalgic. They like it because that's what they grew up on.
You know,
that's
even
what they know.
Gamer nostalgia is a huge part of
well,
this.
Well, even as a man who...
And I don't think gamer nostalgia is a bad thing.
Well,
but.
Even as a man who is a second edition fan, I can admit some of it's nostalgia. Just because I had so many early gaming experiences with it that it's hard for me to view it in a negative light. Having said that, I don't think that tells the entire story. But I will have to confess that, yeah, that is some part of it.
Yeah, it is. And you know, we still don't have third edition Spelljammer yet. I'm waiting. I got a sinking feeling that we're going to get fourth edition before Spelljammer.
First campaign setting they're going to release for fourth edition is Spelljammer.
Oh, they better. This is like the Nintendo 64 Metroid that never came. Well, there's a hole in my heart to this day.
And you know why? Because in addition to your regular battle maps and personal minis, they can release star maps and ship minis.
Oh my God. And actually, I think they're already doing that.
Giant hamster minis.
Oh, I was talking about Star Wars, but hell yeah. Oh. Bring on the Spelljammer minis.
Well, you know, that is a question. Before we close out the Star Wars Saga Edition thing, my one beef with D20 Star Wars is the ship combat system sucked bad.
I have not reviewed
Saga
Edition the ship combat very much. In fact, in my initial flipping through, I didn't find it. So
it's
very
10 times better.
Yeah, sadly, it was so bad.
When we get to ship combat, I am sneaking out my DOS box, and we were playing X-Wing versus TIE Fighter to settle it all.
I can't argue with that. Though, actually, if you go forward to...
You're hitting too much. Your character's not that good. Miss more.
You go forward to X-Wing Alliance, you get some additional ships, like my cloak-shaped fighter that I'm so attached to.
I wanted to love Alliance. I really did. I couldn't.
Alright,
it's like a Sergio Leone movie. Started real, real slow, and you fell asleep. I'm sure at the end there was a great shootout.
I enjoyed it. Well, actually, later on in the game, they did have some neat stuff in there that was not in the previous games. But I sat through the early parts, and yeah, you're right. The first few missions were fairly damn boring.
Few, multiple. I'm like, all right, this is the feeler mission where I move a container because I'm a farm boy. Oh, my life will be so disrupted by the Empire. 10 missions later, there are rumors that a Star Destroyer is somewhere in the galaxy.
But you are the best cargo hauler
I
at
am.
The station. You've hauled grain. You've hauled
don't
ore,
forget foodstuffs and some treachery too.
Slipped a little bit of treachery in there.
Damn you, Admiral Harkal, or Zarin, as it were.
Alrighty, well, we are talking about conflict. Let's talk about Fog of War, but we are going to talk about it at the gaming table.
Whoa!
And looking at where we are in the episode, depending on how meaty this gets, our intended topic for today of voluntary player isolation. Continuing from last episode's involuntary player isolation, may get hit, or this may actually get bumped to the next episode.
If we push voluntarily, that off, that's fine, because Mike wants to talk about it.
Oh, does he?
Yeah, he does.
Okay.
Well, so we'll just kind of babble needlessly on Fog of
right.
War.
I can direct a discussion on Fog of War to Warcraft versus Warcraft 2, and we can just go.
Well, what we've decided to do to draw out the episode is we each now have a personal bumper. Every time one of us is about to speak, there will be a 30-second musical interlude specific to that person.
Yes.
It's kind of like a wrestling theme song that we come running out to, except it will precede every single sentence we say throughout the course of a conversation.
It'd be like if they played those songs at the ballpark between every swing when the batters come up. It'd be great.
All right, so Fog of War at the table. And what we're talking about by Fog of War at the table is keeping people at the table, players, GM, from knowing things that other people at the table know. And there's several angles we're going to spin this one from. The one we're going to start with is, what is the best way to tell a player something without raising the alarm of other players? For example, let's say we're playing a game and Adam's character, for example, does a scan of himself and notices a physiological
problem. That's very private.
In himself that he does not want you, this also may be based on a real story, that he doesn't want to report to the rest of the party because he's afraid they'll be suspicious of him. So he does
this.
That's
witchcraft in the Middle Ages.
Yes, it is.
Now, of course, if I say out loud, well, nothing, you find nothing wrong, obviously everybody knows that. If I pass him a note, chances are, just because of the way human nature works,
the game
know.
Is instantly revitalized and people are riveted.
Yes.
This is great.
This is perfect.
Do this as conspicuously
as
possible.
And you also drop out the, well, I tell you this, but nobody else knows it. And then when everybody else plays their characters, everybody else knows it.
Right. Because if I pass you a note, no matter how much people are trying to play in character, you as a human being can't do a very good job of pretending to not to know things do know.
Yeah, it's classic. Exactly. I used to do this all the time in my group.
I do it all the time.
Well, Chad, you had a great solution I want to bring up. But the issue basically is that the out-of-character knowledge will spill over into your in-character motivations, that everyone suddenly becomes suspicious of Adam without
any reason whatsoever.
Any reason to do so. Chad, you had a great solution.
Oh, I did this all the time.
This is brilliant.
It, like, Adam would be sitting there and, you know, everybody would kind of be like, well, yeah, I don't know why I went, yeah, maybe, we, you know, those are low moments. So what I'd do is I'd take a piece of paper and I'd very conspicuously, like, write a note and it'd say, hey, Adam, what's up? And then I would fold
That's it.
It would ever say. And I would fold it over, I'd look right, and I'd look left, and then I would slide it to Adam kind of under the table, totally obviously. And he would take it and he'd look at it, and then he'd look up at me with this perplexed look on his face, and before anybody could read the note, I would snatch it away from him and crumple it up and put it under one of my books so no one can read it. And people would look at him and go, well, what'd the note say? And he would say, it said, hey, Adam, what's up? And of course, no one would believe him at all. They would totally think that he was like trying to hide
subconscious
something.
Subconscious message, always give the note to the group liar.
Yes, exactly.
Yeah. Well, I think the thing you can't get around is you have to do things in the course of a game that will raise suspicion.
Yes.
Period. And I don't think there's a way that you can hide those so well as to avoid ever raising suspicion. And so the best thing you can do instead is practice the first law of misinformation, which is to mix truth and lie.
Mm-hmm.
And instead of trying to be really slick about hiding the truth, just start putting in lies, like Chad suggested. Yeah. Pass people notes when nothing is going on.
Or make them roll.
Yeah.
And
yeah.
Then, oh. Yeah. And then slide them
roll
a note.
Roll two dice.
If we're,
ooh.
Oh my God, I rolled a one. What did I roll for?
Another example.
You're going to find out soon.
And you know what? They didn't roll for anything.
Yeah.
Another example of this is a lot of times when people like, oh, I'm searching the room. And if nothing's in there, the game master just says, oh, nothing's in there. But if something's in there, the game master says, roll for that.
The edition Dungeon Master Guide tells you always to roll.
And so now your players instantly know something is in the room.
And of course, if they don't roll high enough the first time, 6 hours in the room.
Right.
That's taking 20, baby.
And that's why it's better just to have them roll every time they're going to search. And if you want to get away around this another way, because if they roll that 10, they may think it's not good enough and then sit around until they get the 20, you roll for them. And just tell them, okay, you search and you don't find anything. And maybe there's nothing there to begin with.
You know what I really like? I like it when my players start passing each other notes and I have no clue what they're talking about. They're like planning something. I have been, as a game master, I have had my players kick me out of the room before.
Yeah, we have done that.
So that they could plan something.
Well, I've had to do that in games because I have played with so many game masters that, in my mind, outright cheat, where it's like I come up with some clever plan to knock some enemy off or whatever, and there's no possible way the guy could have seen it coming, could have reacted to it, whatever.
But they do.
But they do.
See, it's just stupid because it ruins the story. I want to be kicked out of the room. I want them to do no stuff because I want my players to surprise me.
I can remember a Star Wars game where I and another guy were having a meeting with all these bad guys, and I wrote a note, and on that note, I put down an action, folded it up, and I handed the game master and said, don't open it. I'm declaring a secret action to you, and I want you to know I'm doing it right now, but don't open it. So we conclude the meeting. I get up and leave, and I tell him, okay, now open the paper, and it says that I had rolled a thermal detonator under the table on a timer. So as soon as I walk out of the room, they're all still sitting there, explode. Because I knew this game master. I told him I'm rolling a thermal detonator under the table so that when the meeting ends, they're all killed. They're going to find some reason to have to leave before it goes off.
It worked for Hitler.
And so
actually, it didn't work for Hitler.
No, it did. It didn't work for the conspirators.
No, it didn't work for... Oh, I gotcha.
So I ended up... I kind of had to do that to work around the Game Master to maintain that fog of war where his NPCs, i.e. he, the Game Master, didn't know what I, the player, was doing.
His personal vessels with which to oppose you and your machinations.
That drives me nuts.
DM versus PC games?
No, not that, but leveraging out-of-character information against...
Oh, yeah, that drives me nuts, too.
Yeah. I take the complete opposite extreme of that, and I will purposefully go way out of... Well, this guy does this suspicious thing. I don't suspect anything.
Yeah.
Don't even look at them.
The thing is,
I'm too busy.
As a GM, I want my players to succeed. I give them advantages. I want them to overcome the obstacles.
It's very hard, though, to find people in general who really, truly can detach their in-character and out-of-character knowledge. That if they know out of character, they're going to walk into this room and something's going to kill them. The vast majority of players, despite the fact their characters have no reason to suspect,
are
suddenly going to find some excuse to not go into that room. Good example of this is I can't tell you how many games I've played where somebody has a low intelligence, low wisdom character, yet they still seem to act with the same intellect the person playing them has.
Well, you know, if Phil's playing, that's perfectly accurate.
Ow.
This is just preparation for the praise episode.
Well, he's,
Did you see he's like, hey, can I be on my own praise episode? No. You cannot be on your own praise episode.
It's like roasting yourself.
Yeah. Exactly. You can't roast yourself.
Are we going to do a Phil praise? Oh, that's right, because we're so mean to him all the time.
You want
to
do one tonight?
Maybe.
Maybe.
Okay.
Maybe. I still have an interview I haven't edited yet, so maybe. Yes. But, of course, bonus episodes don't require editing. So maybe we'll do a Phil, well, I don't know. You, the listeners, just keep watching the feed. There may or may not be a Phil praise bonus episode that drops this week. Anyway, getting back to Fog of War. Let's talk the player-to-player side now.
I have the same problem with this that I do with the GM-to-player.
Now, you're talking, like, what? The GM says...
I scan myself, and I'm like, Dan says out loud, well, you have this thing wrong with you, and it may be impairing your judgment.
You have a bomb planted in you, and he says that out loud.
I have an alien symbiote in me.
And none of the characters know. Now all the players know. Now they're all standing 8 feet away from you.
Right.
Everybody, never come
the
near
bomb
you.
Squad has showed up.
Somebody,
what are these guys doing?
Routine check.
They're just here to party.
for no reason, Adam now needs medical scans. He did not need before.
Dude, you're not looking well. How about a full body MRI?
Or somebody grabs the rule book, looks up explosives. Okay, I stand 30 feet and 1 inches away from him at all times.
Hey, man, are you the pilot? Yeah. We hired a guy to do that.
Yeah. We got this droid. He's really stable with regards to exploding.
That drives me nuts.
Well, how do you get around it?
Someone's obviously to keep the information on the down low. But I guess, I tell you, man, once that box is open...
You can't close it.
See, it's all about playing IC. It's all about
enforcement
of play.
But that's so hard when you're ignoring facts that you know that could damage you, and then not... Playing dumb is hard.
I think that players need to let go of that thing of this is a game that I can win in I can't be hurt. I don't want my guy to be hurt, and I want all advantages for him. You know, talk to the slimy alien symbiote bomb guy and role play with him and get right next to him and risk your life, you know, because it's about the interaction. It's about the role play. It's about playing IC. It's not about keeping your character 100% safe all the time.
I think the only thing you can really do is have that metagame conversation. You just stop the game and you're like, all right, seriously, Bob, stop. You know, you have no reason. I realize I just passed him a note and you, Bob, have perfect reasons to suspect. but your character, Fytor, has no reason to suspect that this guy is secret, is has a spirit.
But Fytor doesn't suspect his own existence.
If Fytor gets his arm blown off, Fytor can no longer fight. And what a tragedy that would be.
Well, I mean,
then he'd just be Tor.
No one wants Tor.
I mean, if you're really worried about, okay, so we go back to the guy with the bomb in him example. If you are super worried that the GM is just going to kill your character at any point because this dude just explodes, one, there's a problem with your game.
Yeah.
And yeah. Two, your GM's probably a bit bloodthirsty to begin with.
And two, there needs to be the trust in that dialogue. You say, you stop everything and you say, dude, GM, are you just going to kill us at random intervals, or is this actually going somewhere?
Yeah.
And then if the GM says, oh, I got nowhere to go with this, then you stand 30 feet and 1 inch away from the guy the whole time.
Yeah, if the GM is one of those people, it's like, is he going to kill us? Like, I don't know. The last five campaigns, you know, the floor just opened up and the swallowed us ended. And the campaign ended.
And then we played Wii for 3 hours.
Yeah, so what's any different? Then you start doing metagame stuff because at that point, it's a competition.
Yeah.
And then that night, you get on the Fear the Boot forums and go to the gamer hookup section and find a new group in your area.
Because you've got a problem with your GM.
And complain, and then go to the episode review section and say how wonderful this episode was.
That's right.
Because we saved your gaming life for the next 5 years. Well,
actually, then everyone else is going to say, man, he's got such informed opinions on gaming. I've got a GM for him. And there you go.
Actually, I think we even talked about this. It was either in our player faults or GM faults episode. We talked about the player. I think we talked about this, didn't we? The player versus GM competition.
Yeah, I think we did.
Mentality.
Role-playing games are not a competition.
Yeah, the game
you
master.
You cannot win a role-playing game.
Exactly.
You cannot lose a
role-playing game. My miniatures say otherwise.
Yeah. I think John said this. You cannot win a role-playing game, but you can definitely lose a role-playing game.
I might have said that. It sounds rather bleak for my typical cheery tenor, but, it's potent.
I think the biggest problem that I've had in the Fog of War thing that is not easily solved is people that play the letter of the law without playing the spirit of the law, where they find things that they can come up with excuses for their character doing that stretch credulity.
Are so out there.
But don't quite break credulity because they've got good, they're intelligent enough to come up with reasonable excuses.
I've been in the military for 10 years and now I'm paranoid, so I scan everyone I'm with at every opportunity.
Right.
Why have you never done this before?
Yeah.
Well, it was just assumed.
It was just assumed you're irradiating
but
everyone.
But I cast Mordenkainen's magical watchdog. I said it. I did.
I totally said it. It's right here on my character sheet.
The Fog of War thing, I think basically what it comes down to is it's a metagame issue and it has to be fixed with metagame solutions. So
yeah, role play your character. Don't try and win. It's okay if you get hurt and maimed by the slimy alien symbiote bomb that is in Adam that you don't know about. Yet you really do.
You're just going to have to fight a xenomorph. That's easy. Yeah. Adam is going to have no chest.
That's hard.
Yeah.
Try role-playing through that one, jerk. What do you do this round? Oh, I die more.
I bleed.
I don't know, maybe I can find another face hugger and get 2 for 1.
Whoa, guys, I never rolled initiative for bleeding. Hold on.
We got a couple minutes left in this episode.
And we told you we were going to do some bloat.
Right, so here comes the bloat. We were asked, in all seriousness, we don't want to do the voluntary...
Transparent meta-podcasting. I like it.
We don't want to do the voluntary player isolation thing, because that's going to be too meaty for what's left on this episode. But we did have a request. We're going to go ahead and fill. Someone asked us, we did, 2 episodes ago, our least favorite... our most embarrassing RPG purchase. Someone asked us to juxtapose that with the positive. What is the best RPG purchase we have ever made? Anyone here want to start? If not, I'll go ahead and start.
No, wait, are you saying
RPG purchase?
Yeah, are you saying the best little gem we've found or our favorite game that we've ever
bought? No, what I'm saying is if you had to point to a single book and say of all single books I have ever bought, I am the most glad that I bought this one. I've gotten more use, more mileage, more gold out of this one book than any other. What book would that be?
I can go.
Oh, Riffs, definitely.
Now, I'm not talking comedy gold.
Source material for a podcast for 50 weeks.
I'm talking that actually enriches your game.
The BattleTech
Mercenaries Handbook.
The original or the second one?
The original.
Oh, you have the original?
Maybe.
Wait, what book again?
The Battletech Mercenaries Handbook? The one we use to build our...
You don't have the original.
You have this. You probably have the second one. Yeah, the original would be very hard to find. Mm-hmm.
Wait, do you have the original?
Probably.
That's the one I'm talking about.
I might.
And when I say purchase, I mean look.
Is it the one that on this one? Is it the one that on the cover has the guy like sitting down with his back up against a wall, looks like he's in some kind of like a waiting room?
Yes. Yes.
That's the second one. That's not the first.
Okay.
So what does the first one have on it?
I don't remember, but that's the one he's talking about is the second one.
Okay. Then that one.
That is a damn good book. I got a lot of mileage out of that in my Battletech.
We built an operational game where we pulled it back one level and made turns and stuff.
Yeah. Well, actually, cool. Even just some of the stuff they had in there, like what's in a repair kit, has gone a long way in my
campaigns.
Pricing. If I, though, had to pick a single favorite book, I'm going to answer this in two ways. The one that I actually own that I'd say I've gotten the most mileage out of is Battletech's Objective Raids. And the reason is what it does is all it defines is what is on various planets.
Yeah.
And it is beautiful setting information. So when my party goes to a planet, I've got forces that are on the planets, names of major peoples, names of major industries, maybe even a little bit of ecology or local economy information. However, if I was to pick the single best RPG book or most helpful one I have ever seen, and I didn't own this, and I'm going to get the name here a little bit wrong. It's Aurora's Equipment Guide, or it's something like this. It's Aurora's something, Aurora's Equipment Guide or Aurora's Equipment Handbook for D&D. And all it is a source book that lists common everyday stuff. Like, you want to know the price in D&D for just about anything. This book has so much just stuff in it. And normally, I wouldn't be this big of a fan of a pure list book. But some of this equipment they have in it is so creative and is so useful to role-playing, even just simple situations, that I absolutely loved the book. Chad, John?
Well, I'm also going to have to kind of answer out of both sides of my mouth, because the thing that sprang immediately to my mind was the second edition starter box set with the little mini player's handbook and the mini DMG and monsters manual. If the infinite dragonflight was going to drop down at any point in my life and knock me off of the train tracks of gaming, they could stop me from buying that, and I probably wouldn't be here. That said, the single supplement that I think better answers this question is probably the second edition Dungeon Builder's Guide, which was really, really good. I don't know if any of you guys bought it. It came out pretty late in the second edition life cycle. But it had...
Is that the one where the cover, there's like these sort of wizard-type guys in a field, and there's a table, and they're planning charts and stuff, and then there's, in the background, ogres and giants and stuff lifting big
there
stone...
There might be. I think there's like a genie kind of guy on the front.
All right,
scratching
what was in this book?
There were... The basic argument that the book made was that you can make a dungeon that makes sense in a fictional universe. Don't lock a red dragon on a pile of gold. Adventurers will find its skeleton years later because it can't eat gold. But they had lots of great ideas about traps and, you know, underwater dungeons, alternate plane dungeons, abandoned structures, occupied structures, plot hooks.
I have noticed that a lot of dungeons really don't make any sense.
Yeah.
For no particular reason, there's this massive labyrinth underground with monsters and level-appropriate loot beneath
them. Dan, you're not playing for sense.
Exactly.
You're playing for traps and loots.
See, that's the thing.
Dungeons
it totally married the traps and loots with the, yeah, you can do this in a fictional campaign without totally whoring yourself out to, well, it's a game.
See, it's dungeons and dragons, not dungeons, dragons, and a storyline.
Dungeons, dragons, and a glowing fungus which sustains underground life.
Chad?
I would have to say it is two Shadowrun books that I bought.
What?
First one.
This doesn't surprise me, actually.
The first, and I'm sure you could probably guess which ones it is, because you know my favorite Shadowrun book.
Neo-Anarchist's Guide.
Guide to North America.
Yes.
That was a great book.
It was a really good book. I didn't use any of it, and I don't think any of us used any of the actual concepts in the book. Maybe we did, I don't remember. It had no game mechanics in it whatsoever, at least not that I remember. It was a great read.
Yeah.
I mean, it was just fun to read.
It was vast amounts of setting information, very good detail. And on top of that, it had tons of game aids. Like, for example, if you wanted diagrams of, like, banks, it had diagrams of banks and would explain the kinds of security you'd find in there.
And the kind of people you'd find in bars, watering
bars,
hole club,
corporate offices,
houses, cultural museums,
tons of
YMCAs.
Yeah, had tons of pre-generated NPCs. So if you need additional contacts or on the fly, you need to okay, they ran into such kind of person, you could flip open it had additional pre-generated
NPCs. Every single role-playing game system setting out there, in my opinion, must have a book like the Neo-Anarchist Guide to North
America. It was great. I have to agree with you. I didn't own it, but that was a great book.
Yep.
What was your second one?
What do you think it is?
I'm going to guess the Street Samurai Guide.
Sure is. Street Samurai Guide was awesome. It was... When you boil it down and you take all the cool stuff that I liked out of it, it was nothing more than a list of guns and armor and their damage stats. What FASA did is they took that and they made it interesting. They conceptually turned it into a catalog like you'd buy.
Ares.
They would have a marketing blurb in there. They would have nice picture of the gun. And in the bottom of it, they would have an IRC type of chat line where people were chatting about the guns or the armor or the whatever, and people would be like, oh, don't believe that, it's really like this, or, you know, it's like, oh, I used one and I mowed down these guys, and it was all pretty Shadowrunny hard ass type stuff, which was fine because it fit into the IC-ness of the book.
Some of it wasn't, because it was just the hacker defacement.
Yeah.
And on some of them, it was just people just say the most random crap, and then the guy beneath them was like, what is this guy smoking?
Yeah, what are you talking about?
Well, welcome to Wikipedia.
Yeah. Yeah. You know what?
Wikipedia.
It was great because it was an internet chat room before those were really popular.
Yeah.
It was very, very cool.
ASL.
I have to agree with Chad. They did a great job.
Kelly.
They did a great job of dressing up what was otherwise just an equipment guide.
Yeah.
And I'll have to agree, that was a really well put together book. So, there you go. Something positive from Fear the Boot.
About Shadowrun, no less.
From Chad.
We apologize for
being
the
positive.
Bloat something. And we will catch you guys next time.
See ya.
This has been a production of Fear the Boot, copyright 2007, fully owned by its host. Our theme song was written and performed by Tim White. Listeners are free to use the show in any non-commercial endeavor, as long as credit is provided to FearTheBoot.com. You can find previous episodes and other resources at FearTheBoot.com.